This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. Hospital officials said Wednesday Israeli airstrikes across Gaza killed at least 34 people, including 19 women and children. The strikes at a UN school sheltering displaced Palestinian families, as well as two homes. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says six staffers were among the dead. The Israeli military said it targeted the school in central Gaza because Hamas militants were planning attacks from there. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres is criticizing Israel for what he says is a lack of accountability for the killing of UN staff and humanitarian aid workers in the Gaza Strip. In a wide-ranging interview with Reuters Wednesday, Guterres condemned Hamas's deadly attack on southern Israel last October 7th that sparked the current war.
But then afterwards, we have witnessed a series of military interventions by Israel in Gaza with a level of death and destruction that has no parallel in my time as a Secretary General, and with very dramatic violations of international humanitarian law and the total absence of an effective protection of civilians.
The UN says nearly 300 humanitarian aid workers, more than two-thirds of them UN staff, have also been killed during the 11-month-old conflict. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and British Foreign Minister David Lammy traveled to Ukraine's capital Kyiv on Wednesday. With Kyiv at a critical juncture in his struggle against Russia, Blinken said he wanted to hear directly from President Volodymyr Zelensky what Kyiv's goals are in the war and what Washington can do to help it achieve them.
We remain fully committed to Ukraine's victory, to not only ensuring that Ukraine can defend itself today, but can stand on its own feet strongly, militarily, economically, democratically, for many, many days ahead.
This is VOA News. Blinken and Lammy pledged nearly $1.5 billion in additional aid to Ukraine during Wednesday's visit. A year after a massive earthquake struck Morocco's High Atlas Mountains, people there say reconstruction has been slow, and many are still living in tents or have been forced to move elsewhere. Lisa Bryant reports.
Morocco's High Atlas region is one of the poorest and most underdeveloped parts of the country. The government has earmarked $11 billion in aid to reconstruct the area, while tens of thousands of earthquake-affected people have gotten state support. Reports say many have yet to get the full payment. Reports also say many residents still live in plastic tents or have been forced to relocate. Some have protested for more support. Lisa Bryant, VOA News.
Parts of Vietnam remain severely flooded Wednesday after the deadly Typhoon Yagi hammered the southeastern Asian nation with torrential rains. Reuters correspondent Diane To has that story.
Officials have reported scores of people dead and missing, mostly from flash floods and landslides. Authorities in Hanoi evacuated thousands of people from their homes along the Red River as its waters rose to a 20-year high. Yagi was the most powerful typhoon to hit Asia this year, bringing catastrophic flash flooding to neighboring Thailand as well. At least two people were killed and hundreds stranded after heavy rain swept through two northern provinces, swelling rivers, inundating settlements, and triggering mudslides, Thai authorities said on Wednesday. And about 9,000 households have been impacted.
That was Reuters correspondent Diane To. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump met for what could be their first and only presidential debate Tuesday. Here's VOA's Dora McCower.
Fans on both sides felt the vice president successfully goaded the former president.
Trump, you know, I think that he got baited a couple times with some of her personal jabs, like his rally sizes, people leaving his rally early.
It's very clear that she's on her best game and that she's willing to take him on in a clear way.
Early signs suggest that neither candidate performed strongly enough to win over significant numbers of undecided voters, the very people who could decide the election. While Harris's team is calling for another matchup, Trump says he is less inclined to debate Harris a second time. Dora McQuarrie, VOA News, Washington.
International Edition delivers insight into world news through eyewitnesses, correspondent reports, and analysis from experts and newsmakers. We also keep you in touch with social media, science, and entertainment trends. I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 12, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United States pledges support for Africa's artificial intelligence goals.
We aim to foster collaboration between the United States and African AI researchers, policymakers, and industry leaders so that we can work together to drive innovation and address common challenges.
A study finds that conflict has closed 14,000 schools in 24 African countries. A year after Morocco's earthquake, the country's High Atlas region is still recovering. Athlete toxin kills hundreds of dogs in southern Malawi. Will South Sudan be able to hold elections this year as scheduled?
Even if there is a deal or no deal, everyone is saying that it's a bit too late now for the country to go for elections. We're talking of 3 months away. There are lots of obstacles that have not been addressed.
An early poll suggests that Kamala Harris won Tuesday's presidential debate, but will it affect the vote? Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Delegates from more than 30 African countries and the United States have wrapped up a two-day artificial intelligence summit in Nigeria to promote the safe development and deployment of AI in Africa and beyond. Timothy Obiezu has more on the summit, which was a partnership between Nigerian authorities and the United States.
The two-day Pan-African AI conference, co-hosted by the United States, concluded Wednesday in Lagos, Nigeria's commercial hub. Hundreds of delegates, including public officials, tech leaders, policymakers, academics, and entrepreneurs, attended the conference to hold talks about the deployment and use of safe, secure, and trustworthy AI systems in Africa. The U.S. Deputy Secretary of State, Kurt Campbell, spoke at the summit about the opportunity at hand.
A global technology revolution is well underway. The race to develop and deploy new technologies, including artificial intelligence, is already shaping everything about our lives. We aim to foster collaboration between the United States and African AI researchers, policymakers, and industry leaders so that we can work together to drive innovation and address common challenges. This will enable us to share the benefits of AI globally.
The conference is a significant step in Africa's technological future. Campbell said artificial intelligence can be used to address problems like global health, food security, education, energy, and climate change, and asserted the conference has provided the ground for African voices in AI to shape emerging global AI systems.
I cannot overstate Africa's growing importance in the global technology landscape. By developing human capital and strengthening research and innovation ecosystems, and building an AI-ready institutional and regulatory environment, we can help AI work for Africa. The African Union's landmark AI strategy sets the roadmap for African countries to harness AI's potential to achieve developmental aspirations in education, health, agriculture, infrastructure, peace, and security and good governance.
In July, the African Union launched the continent's artificial intelligence strategy, saying AI is pivotal to transforming Africa into a global technology hub, and it called on member states to adopt the strategy. On Tuesday, Nigeria's Minister of Communication, Innovation and Digital Economy, Bosun Tijani, announced a $61,000 grant for Nigeria's brightest AI startups.
For us to truly unleash artificial intelligence for our collective benefit, we must be deliberate and collaborative in our approach. We must ensure that our digital transformation journey is inclusive, equitable, and human-focused.
Africa currently represents 2.5% of the global AI market, according to the Artificial Intelligence for Development Africa, or AI4D. But analysts say with more talks about safe use, AI applications could boost Africa's economy by $2.9 trillion by the year 2030, with Kenya, South Africa, and Nigerian markets taking the lead. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
More than 14,000 schools in 24 African countries have been closed due to conflict and insecurity affecting the education of millions of children. An international aid agency warns that children who are not in school are at risk of being recruited by armed groups, forced into child labor, or the threat of physical violence and sexual exploitation. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Millions of African children are without education as schools struggle to cope with the impact of armed conflict and insecurity. The Norwegian Refugee Council says that as of June 2024, more than 14,300 schools were closed in 24 African countries. Countries with the most closures were Burkina Faso, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Cameroon, Chad, Nigeria, and Niger. Christelle Ihe works with the NRC's Western Central Africa office.
We have now more than 14,000 schools that have been forced to close because of violence, and this has an impact on an estimated number of 2.8 million children. And so it means that these children are deprived of education, but also more vulnerable to different protection risks.
The latest figure is an increase of 1,100 closures from the previous year, when 13,200 schools were closed due to conflict and insecurity. Aid agencies say the lack of instruction makes it easy for the armed groups to recruit children, disrupting their education and further decreasing their chances of ever attending classes. The lack of schooling also makes children vulnerable to violence and exploitation, perpetuating a cycle of poverty and instability. In some countries, conflict has nearly overwhelmed the education system. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, says one in four schools in Burkina Faso is closed. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, at least 1,450 schools nationwide were closed as of January, affecting 500,000 students. 47-year-old Risasi Mwinyi Patience, a Congolese refugee living in Uganda, and two children were among those affected by school closures in the DR Congo. Fighting in Congo's Ituri province claimed the life of his wife. He fled to Uganda in April, seeking safety. He says the school in Congo where my children were enrolled has been closed and everyone has run away. The children were in grade 6 and grade 4 in Congo. He says, I have admitted them to school here so that they don't idle in the camps. A head of the NRC says the circumstances that cause school closures vary from country to country.
What we observe is that there are three main reasons. First reason is really for a military purpose. You know, it's about regaining or gaining control over territory. The second reason is schools are seen by non-state armed groups as a symbol of the government's authority.
Patience is concerned about his future and that of his children, who are forced to start education again due to the language barrier. Schools in the DR Congo are taught in French. He says here, my children have to restart their education because they don't know English. Though the general situation remains dire, some schools have reopened in Central African Republic and Mali due to improved security, and in Burkina Faso, some 1,300 schools have reopened since October 2023. The Oslo-based agency calls on the international community, governments and warring parties to protect education by ending attacks on schools and ensuring the safety of learners and teachers. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
A year after a massive earthquake struck Morocco's High Atlas Mountains, people there say reconstruction has been slow and many are still living in tents or have been forced to move elsewhere. Brian reports.
Days after the 6.8 magnitude earthquake struck in September a year ago, tour guide Abdesamat Elzgouri showed a reporter his damaged home in Amis Nez, a town at the foot of the High Atlas Mountains. Cracks covered the outside walls. his family was sleeping outside, fearful of another quake. Parts of Amizmiz were reduced to rubble. In a phone interview, Elsgouri says his house is now being renovated. It's getting more pillars and new foundations to withstand future shocks. For now, his family lives in a rented apartment.
The situation is much better than before. There are less camps, people getting back to their houses. Some they reinforce their house and renovate, some they rebuild. But still we have people living in tents.
Morocco's High Atlas region is a spectacular place. Its beauty and Berber culture have drawn tourists from all over. But it's also one of the poorest and most underdeveloped parts of the country. The government has earmarked $11 billion in aid to reconstruct the area, while tens of thousands of earthquake-affected people have gotten state support. Reports say many have yet to get the full payment. Reports also say many residents still live in plastic tents or have been forced to relocate. Some have protested for more support. Elsgouri says the reconstruction is creating needed jobs, but there's not much else by way of work. He's uncertain about his own job in a changed region.
I do cultural tourism. You show people old houses, authentic houses, the way people lived like 400 or 500 years ago. That's our tourism. That's what our business is about. It's about the Berber culture. And now the situation is different. People are building new houses with new standards. So it's not good for us.
A father of four, Elsgouri, says he's happy the children are back at school. He's less certain about the future of his town and region in the months and years to come. Lisa Bryant, VOA News.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Buckley in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 12th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A week ago, participants in the Kenya-led South Sudan Peace Talks, also known as the Tumaini Initiative, predicted that an agreement could be reached or signed by September 16. In July, First Vice President Riek Machar, a key partner, withdrew from the talks. Meanwhile, South Sudan is supposed to hold elections by the end of the year. Daniel Akech is the International Crisis Group's senior analyst for South Sudan. The group has just published an advisory on the Tumaini Initiative. Akash tells me that the stakes are high for South Sudan and that even an agreement or even an election will not solve all the country's problems.
I don't think it's a normal procedure for the parties negotiating to know when they will sign an agreement in advance, because it has to involve talking and agreeing on things. The parties negotiating in Nairobi are the coalition governments that signed the 2018 peace agreement that involved the president's party, Machar's party, and other parties. Within that coalition, Machar walked out of the negotiations in mid-July 2024, and he hasn't come back yet. So even if the parties were to go ahead and sign anything in this foreseen date of September 16, it would not really have much value.
Let me ask you, therefore, what do you see as the possible implications if there is no deal between President Kiir and Riek Machar?
One of the problems is that there are three dilemmas facing South Sudan as we speak now, one of which is the elections that are supposed to take place in December. The decisions on dissolving the government before the elections are meant to happen at least 3 months before the election date. And if the election date is December 22nd, Machar and the president should agree on dissolving the government, some aspect of the government, and go for election preparation by September 22nd. So it looks like this is a bit too late for that to happen. The third option is for the parties to actually use the Tumaini initiative in Nairobi to extend the agreement. And once they have done that, they will likely postpone the December polls. So if that is not an option, elections cannot happen because the government is incapable of actually organizing elections within the next 3 months, then the option is for Machar and Kiir to agree to do their own extension of the agreement, postponements of elections in Juba. That is pretty remote. So I think if they don't agree, Nairobi is likely going to be the case that not much could be done in Juba. And that means we will walk into next year with lots of problems, potential for violence if these uncertainties remain unresolved.
Also hanging in the balance as we talk about a possibility of a deal is whether South Sudan will be able to hold election at the end of this year.
Even if there is a deal or no deal, everyone is saying that it's a bit too late now for the country to go for elections. We're talking of 3 months away. There are lots of obstacles that have not been addressed. One of the foremost of the obstacles is the merging of the forces that is splintered when the conflicts happened in 2013. These forces are all over. The parties that are supposed to contest in elections cannot contest as long as they have forces under their commands. And now in South Sudan, we do not have a single commander-in-chief. The second obstacle is the absence of voter registrations. So those are big obstacles that cannot be solved within 3 months.
Do you think South Sudan will continue to enjoy the support of the international community and also the East African community in case there is no deal or no election by the end of this year?
Thank you, James, for these questions. South Sudan has not been doing very well with the transitions, and there is lots of expectations from the leaders to if they go for further extensions, there should be a clear signal to the rest of the world and to the regions and to the citizens inside South Sudan that these new extensions will be different, that actually the extension for agreements are not used to prolong the stay in power by the top elites. Without doing that, it's going to be difficult to convince the regions to get involved or to actually help the South Sudanese government.
Daniel Akerchis, the International Crisis Group's senior analyst for South Sudan. He was speaking with us from Brussels, Belgium. Malawi has recently recorded the sudden deaths of dogs after consuming meals prepared from maize husk and contaminated with aflatoxins. Veterinary experts said the country has recorded 450 dog deaths since April, when the first cases were identified in Malawi's commercial city, Blantyre. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Aflatoxins are toxic substances produced by fungi that grow on pet food ingredients like peanuts, corn, and other grains. Experts warn that the accumulation of these toxins in an animal's body can lead to liver damage, blood clotting, and in severe cases, death. Timothy Manda is the veterinary clinic manager at the Blantyre Society for the Protection and Care of Animals, which has been testing the dogs. He told VOA that symptoms include a yellowish tint on the dog's skin, hemorrhagic diarrhea or body diarrhea, and sometimes vomiting.
Well, for the past 2-3 weeks, we haven't received any dogs suffering from the problem. But from the time it started somewhere around April up to somewhere around early August, the estimations could be somewhere around 450 dogs so far have died.
He says the aflatoxin contamination was suspected after noticing that the dogs were not responding to treatment.
Under normal circumstances, once we get the treatment, the right treatment, we could get the good results from the treatment. But in these scenarios, they were all ended up dying despite whatever treatment given. Nothing could work out.
Banda says the affected dogs were those fed with insima, a thick porridge, prepared for maize or maize hassocks. Alfred Mandam, a resident of Kirimba Township, told VOA that he lost three dogs in August.
The kind of food I mostly give out to my dogs is nsima, prepared from flour that is made from the remains of a maize called madea. To me, I thought it was a healthy diet. I wish I knew earlier. I wish I could have done things better to save my dogs. But unfortunately, that's a sad reality that I have faced.
Health experts warn that aflatoxins can also induce tumors in the liver of animals and humans. Health officials in Malawi, where maize is the staple food, have not reported any human deaths resulting from consuming contaminated maize. In Zambia, media reports indicate over 400 dogs died in July after consuming maize meal contaminated with aflatoxins. Malawi authorities are advising dog owners to switch to alternative starches such as rice until the outbreak is contained. Lamech Masina, VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump met for what could be their first and only presidential debate on Tuesday. The early numbers suggest that more than 60 million people tune in to watch the matchup. The race between the two candidates remains tight. VOA's Dora McQuarr explores whether the debate changed people's minds about who to vote for.
Polls taken immediately after the presidential debate on Tuesday suggest Vice President Kamala Harris outperformed former President Donald Trump. But that isn't swaying either candidate's strongest supporters. Like these Trump voters.
I know that under Trump, the economy was much better than it has been under Biden. I think his abortion issue comments were pretty strong.
Trump actually secured the border. Why should we have these criminals in our country invading and then basically polluting, harassing, and destroying our communities?
Or these Harris supporters.
I thought she was on fire. She was succinct. She was sure of herself. She spoke policy. She was positive when he was negative.
I am so glad that she is touching on some of the tough issues on the economy, on abortion, on immigration. These are the things that we need to continue to see progress on.
Some Trump supporters felt that the moderators, journalists from ABC News, were unfair to their candidate.
It seemed like they're fact-checking him, but not fact-checking her. So what she's saying is a lot of lying going on. I'm very frustrated by it.
We already knew what this debate was going to look like. It's favored one candidate than the other.
I'm a little frustrated because I think she's had a lot of airspace on things that Democrats are going to be super excited about.
Meanwhile, fans on both sides felt the vice president successfully goaded the former president.
Trump, you know, I think that he got baited a couple times with some of her personal jabs, like his rally sizes, people leaving his rally early. She brought that up, I thought, very strategically.
It's very clear that she's on her best game and that she's willing to take him on. In a clear way.
Early signs suggest that neither candidate performed strongly enough to win over significant numbers of undecided voters, the very people who could decide the election.
I don't know how much it's going to move the needle for anybody that still hasn't made a decision yet. I thought they both had good moments, both had bad moments.
I feel like they're both not the right candidate for me based on this debate and the past debates. So I'm still undecided.
There might not be another presidential debate to help him decide. While Harris's team is calling for another matchup, Trump says he is less inclined to debate Harris a second time. Dora McQuarr, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Thursday, September 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butting, Washington, saying, have a great day, but please be safe, whatever you do.
Ever heard the saying, you are what you eat? It's a powerful reminder of how our food choices impact our health. Recently, the idea of food as medicine has been overshadowed by cheap and convenient processed options. On this episode of Our Voices, we're diving back into everyday food and exploring how they can actually help heal and boost our health. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at